Like, if you only want to become as good as your mentor, then there's no evolution happening. But your mentor should be like your foundation, your base, and then you go further than that.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast with host Nick Hogle. With a schedule always on the move, I was grateful to Patrick Widman for taking the time to sit down and join the podcast, taking me through his journey of personal growth from humbling moments to moments of great achievement. It was great to hear more about his early days in the industry, what keeps him motivated, past mentors, finding new passions, the beginnings of ProTech Tulum, exploration, and much more. Please enjoy. Patrick, I want to welcome you to the podcast. Thank you for making the time. I know just seeing your social media, super busy. Looks like you've been doing a lot of traveling over the last couple months. So thank you very much for making the time, man.
I'm super appreciating to be invited, and I'm stoked to talk about diving and everything related to it. So I'm super keen to be on here. Thanks very much.
No, this is awesome. And then just from what you mentioned real quick, it's like today's a personal day. Do you have to, like, I don't want to say schedule those in, but I'm assuming you're a super busy person in general. So do you always have to say, okay, today is a day that I'm taking for myself doing this, or are you just kind of always on the go?
Honestly, I haven't thought about it. No, it's like a coincidental thing. No, the personal day just happened because I have the podcast with you this morning, and then I have another interview in the afternoon. And then because I haven't had a single moment of rest since January 9th, right? And today is February
6th.
I was either traveling, or I was on trade show, or I was teaching. But having said that, I generally do personal stuff either early morning or late, usually early morning. I wake up pretty early on a regular basis, or like my status quo is I wake up at 5. Of course, that changes a little bit with travel and other stuff. But in general, I wake up pretty early before everybody else is awake. So it's a quite peaceful moment of the day. And then I usually do a regimen of like stretching and or weightlifting or both or cardio. It's for sure somewhat of a health thing, but specifically the weightlifting, not so much the yoga, believe it or not, but specifically the weightlifting I do for my mind, because I do quite a lot of different things in life. So I tend to have quite a lot of like inner monologue and like a lot of things going on, and it's really quite stressful sometimes. But then if I lift really heavy weight, you can't really think about anything else except when to inhale, when to exhale. So I really do this quite regularly, quite frequently, less for the health benefits, but rather for my mind. The yoga is 100% for my body because I broke my back when I was a teenager. So I really have to watch out for like my back. And then, you know, from the diving position in general is really not very good for humans, right? To hyperextend your back and your neck. And so the yoga helps me sort of like, because to keep the doctor away sort of thing. I had really quite huge problems 2 years ago, like for quite some time. I had a hard time putting my socks on in the morning. So the yoga keeps that at bay. And then the cardio is a health thing. I mean, I really can't stand running or any cardio workout, but it's just what has to be done. So rather than, I would say, scheduling specific days, I try to do it every day. And it's just part of, I think if you want to do what I do for a long period of time, it's really not optional. Like, you have to take care about your mind and your body.
For sure. And obviously I'd like to go more into some of the things that you've done and are, you know, in the future that you plan on doing. Just a quick question, just from like a personal question is, so I try, like, I'll get moments, you know, like spurts of time where I'm like, okay, I'll go good for like a couple months. And then sometimes like I'll kind of just fall off. How do you stay motivated to keep doing, you know, to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and then just keep doing it? Is there like just something in the back of your mind saying pushing to do it? Or Like, what is the biggest tool that you have for motivation to kind of keep that up? Because I know it's not easy all the time. Or is it easy for you? I'm not sure.
Not easy. And I don't like it. Well, I wish I would have a good answer for you. The God honest truth is I also fall off every once in a while. In the moment I fall off, however, I also know it's going to be really hard to get back. So when I hit one of those moments when just like all my motivation goes to shit, and you know, it's been a week, I haven't worked out, I haven't stretched, I haven't done nothing, I really, really, really look on how many days it has been, and I understand in my head the more days I let pass, the worse it will be, specifically with weightlifting. If you do a heavy workout after like a long break, it's going to be devastating. Like sitting down and standing up for 2 to 3 days, it's going to be completely agonizing. So I'm trying not to let too many days pass, and I'm trying to say to myself, hey, dude, it's been a couple of days. Let's get back on track. But am I always motivated? Of course not. And to a certain degree, I'm also not trying to make it that much dependent on motivation always. It's more like it's just what has to be done. You know, and in a moment, you don't think so much about do I want to do it or do I not want to do it. It's just a matter of it's just what has to be done. Then maybe it's a bit less of a, you know, just don't start to discussing it with yourself. Like, yeah, of course, there's always a reason not to do it. You know, if you really want to know the God honest truth is, I believe that the most sincere, most genuine feeling of happiness, it can only come from within you. It cannot be external. It cannot be from your friends, your family, your dog, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, buying a new phone, new whatever. All that's external. But true, genuine happiness that comes from within you is when you overcome something, right? When you do something that you thought was difficult and you came out on top, or anything that makes you feel proud about yourself, right? If there's something that you go like, wow, this is really going to be hard. Or I really don't want to do this. And then you do it and you maybe even dominate, or like you do it really good. You're going to come out on the other side and you're going to be really proud about yourself. You're going to look in the mirror and be like, hey, wow, I'm stoked that we did this. And this becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy then also, right? The more often you do that, the stronger your will becomes to do more of that, because at some point you get addicted to that feeling also. You get addicted, maybe not addicted to that feeling, it's a bit exaggerated, but you know, when you succeed, when you do something really good and you're proud about having done it, right? And specifically, if you think like, I guess like the majority of people would not be able to do this, but I did it, right? This feels so good. And then you want to feel more often like that. And then you just, you know, this becomes a really big drive and a big motivator.
I mean, I would even say that it is addicting, because when you have the feelings of accomplishment and then you want more and more of it, and then it could lead to more positive outcomes. But no, that's great, man. Damn, that's pretty deep to start the podcast. I love it, dude. I love it, man. That's awesome.
The reason why I tell you is because, so I was just on a trade show in Paris, and then I was in a trade show in Düsseldorf. And I knew that I had to go to Switzerland to teach, right? And teaching in Switzerland, in the Zurich Lake, end of January, sounded like really insane. And I was complaining to everybody that I met. Nah, dude, I'm going to have to go to Zurich Lake. Visibility is going to be bad. It's going to be really cold. I have a really huge class with a lot of people. Wow, it's going to be like just, I really, really, wow, why I have to do this? And I was complaining and complaining and complaining and complaining. And I was like, I really got myself even almost worked up while I was in Germany. I was like, I really don't want to do this. I talked to my business partner and my really close friend Hans from Jersey. And I was like, Hans, dude, man, I don't know. I'm too old for this. I don't want to do this shit anymore. And he was like, okay, so we have to change, you know. Anyways, you're traveling, you're working way too much. We have to find a way how you can not do things like diving in shitty cold places, but, you know, do the things that you love doing, because you work so hard. It should, you're at a point of your career where you should be capable of or able to choose the things that you want to do and outsource the things that you don't want to do. And it sounded perfect to me. Then first day of the class, sort of cool. Second day, first dive, really good. I'm really, you know, I'm teach, the flow of the class is pretty good. The timing is pretty good. Theory is pretty good. Students are super well prepared, ask amazing questions. and we have really good conversation and they love it, right? And every day in the evening, like, wow, wow, what an amazing day. So come day three, come day four, now I feel like comfortable in the water also. Then I have a short in my heating system. So I spend days of diving in really cold water, 6 degrees centigrade, like 50-ish Fahrenheit, with no heating. And I realize I can do it. I can do 60 minutes. I can do 70 minutes, no heating, right? And now I'm like, wow, this is awesome, because now I'm gaining experience also. So I know if I would be exploring at some point in cold water and my heating would fail, I would actually know 60, 70 minutes in that water temperature, piece of cake, right? Before I'm even considering to feel uncomfortable and before the suffering starts. So now I'm just happy. I wake up every day morning, I'm stoked. I go for a run around the lake, stoked. I go to the shop, everybody's happy. We're having an amazing time. And I'm like, dude, I feel so much happier than I did in the weeks before doing this trade shows and all that stuff. And that's like a weird situation, right? When you realize it's like the thing that I complained the most about that I really didn't want to do now is the very thing that makes me happier than anything else. And that it becomes even stranger, because then I'm like, maybe that's the reason why so many really wealthy people are so depressed. Right? When you watch all the Hollywood actors and everybody's on like, everybody that dies then has like this list of like, well, they have been on anti-anxiety medication and they have been on this and then this and that, and then they all commit suicide. It's like, wow, why would you do? And then you realize, you know, maybe, and of course not all of them. It, just think about that. I think, again, the truest feeling of that, at least in my life, when I feel truly and utterly content and happy to my core, is when I overcame something, when something seemed difficult and then I did it. Right? So imagine you live in a world where you have so much power and influence and money, where you can eradicate all of those things from your life that you don't want to do, that are challenging, that feel. Right? So how are you going to ever get that feeling again? Right? If suddenly you eradicate, if suddenly there's no more challenges, everything that you want to have, you have. Nothing is difficult anymore. Right? You send your assistant to do this, you pay with your millions of dollars. So when are you going to get that feeling of accomplishment? And without that feeling of accomplishment, what do you have to do to, you know what I mean? So, because obviously I spend a lot of time by myself in hotels, and I spend, and then underwater, it's just like, man, I'm like just thinking about things like that. And then I have really amazing friends like Hans, my friend from Jersey. He's a pretty, I mean, he, you know, he has been in marketing for pharma. Huge company, sold it. And he is just a really unbelievable intelligent human being. So I have a lot of like philosophical exchanges with him about stuff like that. Yeah.
No, that's awesome, man. And is he, you know, after he did what he, is he still trying to pursue that next challenge? Because it seems like you're always trying to pursue
that. Of course. Oh, it's like one of our number one conversations, because he has been like on the bench for some time now, so to speak. And now he goes like, because he could just retire, right? And he's like in his late 40s. But he's like, dude, I'm bored. I need something. And I'm like, yeah, get off the bench, bro. Get back into the trenches, man.
No, that's awesome, man. That's awesome.
You know, I believe when you are a creator, when you enjoy creating, you can't. And trust me, man, specifically because of social media, I nonstop receive messages, sometimes from complete strangers. And to all of the complete strangers that have sent me messages, I appreciate you. And I'm not complaining, okay? But, you know, it's weird because sometimes people follow you on social media and then they almost have a feeling like they know who you are, right? And then I get like this messages out of the blue. Hey, we don't know each other. But you know, Patrick, you really are doing too much. Like, you're going to burn out. You should like chill. And I'm like, and I genuinely love their concern, right? Hey, they really took a part of their time, a part of their day to reach out to me out of and send me a concern message. I really appreciate that. But of course, without really knowing me, it's a bit of a weird statement also, because I mean, I understand people love to go to the beach and hang out, right? Or people love Netflix. I do not. You know, for me, the beach is really boring. Really, really, really boring. Like, I'm on the beach for like 5 to 10 minutes and there's no surf. I'm going to be like, and what are we going to do now? Right? Or Netflix. I'm like, yeah, I can do Netflix for like an hour. but that's also kind of boring. So I need to, I rather do something that's like entertaining to me. I was visiting my mother during her birth on the way back from Australia, on the way back to Mexico. And I hadn't had done emails for some time because of travel and stuff. So my mom watches television. I'm on the living room table, headphones on, my two screens up, and I'm just like emailing. And after some time, my mom comes over and she was like, yo, I'm like, what's up? She's like, you're sitting there since 7 hours. You don't wanna come on the couch, watch a movie or something. And I'm like, truth be told, I really rather answer emails than watching German television. Because it's not just answering emails, man. It's what people don't understand. I'm moving chess pieces. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm like, you know, planning trips, you know, how can I fit South Korea with like the Philippines, and then I need to go to Japan, and then I do this, and what plane, and how to travel, and you know what's going to be the cheapest way to go there, and no, not so much layover, but there I need to do emails. So everything is like, I really enjoy it. So most of the time, not always, of course, but people will say, Patrick, your life is easy because you enjoy what you're doing. Not always. You know, like I told you, I complained about going to Zurich for at least 2 weeks. But it just is what it is. So, and most of the time, I really enjoy it. And for sure, at the moment, the traveling, do I miss home? Of course. Do I miss to spend time with my friends and family? Of course. Do I miss my dog? Of course. Like crazy. Am I sometimes, when I look at my schedule, do I get overwhelmed? Yes. Am I looking forward to the next 10 days? I will be here in Poland in a hotel, mostly by myself. And I will write the CE documentation and the user manual for Rebreather. Fucking terrible. I hate computers. Answering emails is easy to me, right? It's a dialogue. You ask me a question and I answer. But like scientific work, like writing a user manual, wow, sounds like the Chinese water torture, bro. So what I'm going to do, what I'm going to do is I have to balance it out, right? So I signed up for like, I'm getting trained in interval running by a marathon runner here, and it's cold outside and I hate the cold, so I know it's going to be a really good challenge. And I just got like this heart monitor belt thingy and like a watch to measure my stuff. And now I'm kind of looking forward to that. And I'm going to be like, that's going to be really miserable and I'm going to really hate it, but in the once I'm back from the run, I'm going to feel really good about myself and about having done it.
Yeah. So is that why you're in Poland right now?
For the, yeah, because here is the headquarters of XDeep and KISS.
Oh, okay.
So I'm very close to the factory here and my business partner, the owner of XDeep.
Well, let me bring it back just a little bit. So generally, I always like to ask, I'm loving how this is starting out though, the just deep thoughts, man. This is, I was kind of telling you earlier to capture the human side and like your bringing that human element, which is awesome, dude. I love it. Like hearing about what drives you, your motivation. But the question I wanted to ask is, tell me about how and why you got into scuba diving. Like, tell me about that first breath underwater. What led to that moment? You know, like, was it a trip or was it something that you've always wanted to do? Cause it's obviously the path that you're on is scuba diving is a big part of your life. Like, did you know when you were taking those first breaths that you would be sitting where you are today, or have an idea, I should say?
I was 12 years old. So okay. No.
So yeah. Hey, some people know they want to be president when they're like five. So, you know.
Interesting question. So first of all, I have to semi-correct you. Diving is not a big portion of my life. Diving is my life, period.
Okay. Okay.
Diving is not something I do. It's something I am. And this has been like this for at least 20 years now. Like literally everything that I do, like also like the you know, like we just said, the physical regimen, like the working out, the stretching and stuff, also the cardio workout and stuff, to a certain degree, it's for sure for my mind and peace of mind. But to a certain degree, it's also to be physically and mentally in shape for the things that I'm doing in diving. So many of the things, because people always think that diving is just like the stuff that you do in the water. And it's like, Well, maybe if you do it as a hobby, but if you do it professionally and specifically if you want to do it like on an expedition style, at some point you will have to do things outside of the water to help you to deal with the stuff in the water. At least if you want to do it, you know, safe and for a long period of time. But to come back to your original question, my parents got divorced and my dad moved away. I mean, away, considering I'm from a 700 people village, but we didn't live in the same house anymore. Right. And he moved to a small city about 10, 15 minutes from where I lived. And my dad was a elementary school principal, but had this unexplainable drive to help people. So he was, and I get the years wrong here, but like, let's just round it. He was about 30 years in the voluntary Red Cross on weekends. And he was also in a voluntary mountain rescue team for 10 years and a voluntary water rescue team, maybe the same amount of time. So the water rescue team met every Tuesday in the evening and then dove on the weekends. And they also had like, you know, rental equipment and stuff like that. So I considered, or I thought it was a great move to join the water rescue team, which I could at a young age, in order to see my dad on Tuesdays and go dive. And then I did my first dive and I remember absolutely everything about it. I remember the smell of the wetsuit. I remember the color of the wetsuit. It was red on the inside, black on the outside with the yellow stripes. Remember the Bruce Lee movie when he has like the yellow jumpsuit with the black stripes? It's exactly in reverse. There was a black suit with yellow stripes. I remember the movement of the seagrass. I remember almost everything about it. It was maybe the most amazing experience I had in my life until that moment. Did I believe afterwards that I'm going to be sitting here one day? Still not. And did I believe I'm going to be a professional diver? Also not. I'm from a, I don't know how you want to call this, but like both of my parents were elementary school principals. My mom in one town and my dad in another. And everybody in my family was, you know, like university and like choosing a career in, with something like that. And so my brother studied medicine first, then was a teacher. So, I mean, I knew that I'm going to have to go to university and study something. The problem was I was terrible in school, dude. Like absolutely horrendous. Quite funny. My teachers in a parent-teacher conference said to my parents, well, we have to just accept one thing. Patrick is just not a language talent, which of course now I'm fluent in four languages. It's a bit weird, but I was terrible in school, dude. Like terrible, 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 terrible. And I remember in the last year, because I went to what is called in Austria, it's called a gymnasium, right? It's a school that teaches you like broad stuff, like broad spectrum. I had philosophy and psychology. I had four languages, like Spanish, French, English, German. I had, you know, history, music, the history of music, the history of art. So it was very, very broad spectrum. Our architectural drawing, chemistry, physics, biology, like very, very broad spectrum. And the idea is you get to experience everything a little bit and then you choose something that you want to specialize in to university. And in the last year, you're doing like a talent test, something like that. And then there is one specific teacher, which is like a confidant type thing from the students. And he's going to like tell you, hey, you know, based on your exam, we see that you have strong tendencies towards math. You know, maybe you should become a math teacher or study math. So anyways, I really, really, really gave this my all, right? Because I was so lost. I had like no idea what I'm going to do with my life. So I gave it my all. And then I'm sitting outside and everybody's in the room with that teacher for like half an hour, 40 minutes, 45 minutes, 1 hour. So it's my turn. I go in and he goes like, well, Patrick, looking at your exam, as expected, we can see that you didn't care and you didn't really try at all. So there's nothing I can tell you. I don't think you're talented for anything. I'm smiling, but I'm burning inside. I'm just devastated. I'm like, Jesus, what am I going to do in my life, man?
So, how old were you at this time?
18.
Oh, wow.
18, okay. 19, I don't remember, one of the two. Because I had to repeat 1 year in school because of, I don't know, 300-something hours of unexplained absence from class. And then I had a bunch of non-evaluated and failed in math. So I had to recover from that shock. But anyways, in the same time, I did a bunch of rock climbing. And long story short, my climbing partner was sick. It was the first day of good weather after the winter where we trained indoors. I wanted to really climb outdoors. I took a guy from my school, gave him like a 10-minute crash course in how to belay somebody. And I should have taken more than 10 minutes. So ultimately, by accident, he dropped me. I fell from 50 meters, 50 feet. Fortunate for me, the floor was really inclined. So if the floor would have been flat, I would have been dead. I mean, 50 feet, bro. No way.
Yeah.
But because the floor was so inclined, I impacted and then like did a whole bunch of somersaults. And I got away with broken vertebras, broken rib, lost some discs. They just got pushed together, liquid came out. But I was alive, right? And then the helicopter or the search and rescue team came, picked me up from the wall, flew me down into the valley, and then I went to the hospital. And yeah, you know, so suddenly my life changed quite a bit because everything in my life until that moment, the only thing that was good at was always sports, right? I was like a sponsored snowboarder, freestyle snowboarding, and I competed in tennis. I did almost every sport, ice hockey, basketball, you name it. And normally after high school, you have to go to military service in Austria. But because I had a broken back, the military said, well, for 1 year, we excuse you. And after 1 year, you have to see a doctor from the government that is going to decide if you are, you know, if you're healthy enough and you're going to get, you have to serve for the military or not. But, you know, I'm 19 years old. I recovered rather quickly. And after 2-3 months, after rehab and everything, I was pretty good. And so then I'm like, what am I going to do now? Right? If I go to university now, first of all, I don't want to go to university without my friends. Second, I have no idea what to study anyways. Right. And if I go now and I go to military afterwards, I'm only going to have to, you know, the year that I did in university and then I go to military, now I'm going to have to redo this year anyways. It's not like I'm going to remember. And then my dad said, why are you not going somewhere as a dive guide for this 1 year? And then you go to military and then you go to university. I'm like, sounds good. So I went to Croatia first, an island called Cres. And then it got really cold very fast because it was October already and there's no more clients. And then over a million different emails in different ways, I ended up in Egypt. And in Egypt, I met my first real mentor, Luigi Annone. And he was like, why do you want to go to university? You're really good in this. And he really made being a diving instructor seem like you have like a PhD or something. My parents were not convinced, I can tell you that much.
What level of diver were you at this point?
I was a KMAS and a dive master. And like a dive master and KMAS levels, yeah. And and then I did my instructor training rather quickly. I was 19 when I became a diving instructor. And yeah, no, dude, I loved it. I mean, I love teaching. I mean, teaching is just what my family does, right? It's like in my genetics, I guess. So I really, really enjoy teaching and quite out of a selfish drive. You know, every time I explain something to somebody, I understand it a little bit better. So yes, I enjoy teaching as in I enjoy sharing my experience with other people and specifically when they appreciate that information and really dig it. But I also get a lot out for myself, right? Because the better and in more intricate and more detail I explain it, the more I understand it. Just like an onion. And I just peel back layer after layer after layer after layer. And there's plenty of times when during explaining something to somebody, I have like this super eureka type sensation. Like, oh yeah, like I don't know. It's hard to explain. But I guess anybody that ever explained something to somebody at some point had this feeling of like, oh yeah, that's how. Like when you give a really good example on how to use it or where it's coming from, it's just really like, wow, yeah, that's exactly how that works. So yeah, so that's basically it in a nutshell. And then I came back from Egypt to that doctor after 1 year, and then he declared me 2% disabled, which was important for my insurance at the time because my life in sports was so intense and I was so much time in hospital that my mom actually made a disability insurance for me when I was like 13. And because of I don't remember if it was 2 or 3%, because of the 2 or 3% disability, I actually got 3,700 euros. From my insurance, which was the exact money or a majority of the money I used in 2007 to buy my first truck in Mexico.
Oh, okay. So how did you end up in Mexico?
So I was in Egypt, right? And I went through the career there rather quickly. So I was a paddy master instructor rather quickly. At that time, I was actually the youngest paddy master instructor in the history of paddy Europe, when paddy Europe still existed in Switzerland, in Hettingen. Which I wouldn't, you know, maybe not that much of an achievement because there's not that many super young people at that time in this. And then I started deep diving. It's a really kind of like long story. I'm going to shortcut it a little bit. So my mentor at the time, Luigi, started technical deep diving in Italy because Paddy at that time just created that new program called TechRec, right? Where they would be teaching people to dive till 50 meter, 170 feet in air. But like with, you know, decompression, it was a new thing for Paddy. At the time, it wasn't even Paddy directly. They used their daughter company called DSAT. And he came back and was like so completely mind blown by how awesome the technique was of ascending and whatnot. And then he unfortunately got electrocuted to death by the shower.
Whoa.
Yes, I was in his living room. We're about to go to have dinner. I hear a scream. And then I see water coming out underneath the door. I open the door and he was dead on the floor. And then the whole story started. Like me, because it was so weird. We just literally together resuscitated a person 2 weeks before on the beach who died of a heart attack. And
damn.
And yeah, dude, the first thing he said is like, whatever happens, don't ever die in a foreign country. And then this shit happened. Yeah. Anyways, his sister was there. Which, dude, it's like the saddest story ever. Dude, his sister was there the first time visiting him abroad in 10 years.
Holy
and then she basically
shit.
Walks in and I'm like on top of her brother giving him CPR. And he was
damn,
30.
Dude.
It was really, really, really terrible. Yes. However, so then I bring all of his stuff I fly to Milan to bring all of his belongings to his family. And his family was like, well, we have no use for all of the diving equipment. So keep that. And then I'm back in Egypt and I'm really, dude, I'm like depressed, man. Now, again, I don't know what to do with my life. And then we had an instructor evaluation and I'm at the pool. I'm like, I don't know, just sitting there. And there was another guy, which then became my second mentor, Oscar Galletto, the owner of D-Tech Dry Suits now. He was at that time the owner of Voodoo Divers. And he came over and he said, hey, dude, I heard that Luigi, you know, the Luigi thing's terrible. And I know that he was your mentor. And, you know, it would be really cool for me to continue what he started. So, you know, I'm doing this tech training and I need another student. You know, if you want, you could be the student and it would be like cheap for you because I was broke, man. Like, you know, I had like no money at all. Because all the money that I made with diving, I like right away reinvested in training. So at the time it was like from my hand into my mouth type of situation. But I just had, you know, inherited, unfortunately, all of this technical diving, like the long hose, the backplate, the wing and everything. And I even remember the number. I think it was 300 something euros he charged me for the class. So then I did my technical training 2003, I think. Anyways, and that got me really hooked. And then I learned that we had a deep diving world record holder living in Sharm el-Sheikh, which was a British guy called Lee Cunningham. And so I did my advanced Trimix class with him. And I remember perfectly when I rocked up there and he looked at me and he was like, how old are you? And I'm like, I don't remember. Maybe I was 21, 22. And he was like, dude, you're a kid. But anyways, so we did, he was like, my average age of the people I teach is like 45. So I did my Trimix class with him. And then I was working in a place that actually had full helium capabilities. And we also had the boat we paid the boats per month. So they were just parked in the harbor. And if they would go out or not go out, the price was the same, right? So the dive center didn't care. And I used to hang out a lot with the boat crews. I was pretty conversational in Arabic. I mean, still am. And I hung out a lot with the boat crews. I really liked the culture, I liked the people. And it was so hot in my apartment in the city anyways that I mostly slept on the sun deck on the boat. So if I asked them on the weekend, hey, boys, you know, can you bring me somewhere to a reef to go deep diving? They were like, yeah, sure. And we used to hang out and they would fish while I was diving. And anyway, so then fast forward, I had a German client and I showed him a cave entrance in Schabruumgammer called. And we would come out and he gave me a book. And the book was from Barbara Mende about Bill Stone in Oaxaca and like the deep diving project he did there in a place called Huatla. And I opened the book in the middle because there's pictures. So this is how educated I am. So I opened the book in the middle with the pictures. And I see them sitting on a ledge with water underneath on rope with a rebreather. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm from the Alps, bro. Right. I did mountaineering from the moment I could walk. So I'm like, you want to tell me there is a sport where I can dive and climb in the same time almost? Jesus, where have you been all my life? So then I started researching cave diving. That was in 2004, end of 2004. I'm starting to research cave diving. I basically boiled it down to like two different people. One was Martin Farr, a guy in the UK, and one was Andreas W. Mattes, also known as Matt, the owner of Protec in Mexico. And Matt just, I don't know, his style of answering was just really my alley. So I grabbed all the money I had, flew to Mexico. At that time, I did money wise pretty okay because I was in charge of training. So the head of training of a chain of dive centers. Dude, and I made really good money, specifically because it was the time of the nitrox revolution. We taught a lot of nitrox classes, which was only 3 hours of theory, but you could teach like 10 people and we would receive like 35 euros or something like that, commission per person. It was really, really good. So I flew to Mexico and told them, hey, I'm here for 2 months. This is the money I have. Show me everything there is to know about cave diving that I can get for this amount of money. And at that time, dude, so I'm like in my early 20s, I'm a Trimix instructor for normoxic Trimix diving. I'm a paddy master. I just think I'm the bee's knees. I think I'm like, I got this. Like diving, this is the summit. I'm like right on top of that guy. And the theory, first day theory was like so still. I'm like still pretty much, you know, very confident. And then we jumped the first time in the water. And I looked at everybody else and I realized I know nothing about diving. Nothing. Those guys go backwards. They stop. They don't move. They are flat. What the heck? This is sorcery. I remember. So because when I went there, it was right after Hurricane Wilma. So the standard place of training is called Ponderosa, or like the pool of pain. And there was current, which is most people that have been diving in Ponderosa know there's no current there. But after Hurricane Wilma, there was quite some current. And we go into the downstream. So we go into the cave with the direction of the water flow. And I don't know how to back kick. I don't know how to stop. But the only thing that was told to us clearly was nobody can ever be deeper in a cave than the person with the reel. It's logic, right? You need to have a continuous guideline to the surface. So if I pass by the dude that lays that line, bad news. So that dive, the guy that laid the line was a local, was Mexican. He wanted to become a cave trained to be a guide, right? To guide Cavan. So, but he had already like practiced there. So he knew how to reverse rocking and whatnot. So basically we're swimming into the downstream of Ponderosa and the guy stops to do a tie-off, right? To connect the line or to wrap the line around the rock. And he takes so much time to do that and I cannot stop. So imagine like I'm a car in first gear with no brakes and the guy in front of me stop. And now I'm just like slow motion. And I'm, every muscle in my body is like, don't pass by the dude that has the reel. And I'm just looking at the instructor and he's looking at me and he's like, don't do it. Just don't pass that guy. And I'm like, man, I'm trying. Yeah, but needless to say, I passed the guy. And then the instructor had to put me back in line. And I was so upset, bro. I came out of the water. I had buckles on my harness at those times. And I literally just opened the buckles and the double tanks just crashed on the deck. And I just walked away and I sat on the floor next to the toilets. I guess maybe I was crying, maybe a little bit. On the inside. Let's just call it on the inside. And then he would come up and he'd be like, yo, what's up? And I'm like, dude, I'm terrible. Like, I do not know how to dive. Like, this is devastating. Right? My ego was crushed so bad. And yeah, so that was my entry to I just remember something from this course, which was quite funny. So there was a chapter back in the day about the attitude of a cave diver, right? And the first question of that chapter is, what is your motivation to become a cave diver? You know, is it ego? Is it like, what's your motivation to become cave diver? And we were three people. There was a Mexican guy. Then there was a Swiss guy, Asian heritage. So Asian guy from Switzerland. And the one thing that I remember from this guy is that he liked classical music. And I just thought, who in his 30s likes classical music? But whatever. No disrespect to Debussy and Wagner and Beethoven. But anyway, so he asks the Mexican guy, hey, bro, why do you want to become a cave diver? And the Mexican guy goes like, dude, I have to provide for my family. I want to be a cavern guide. And cavern guiding seems to be a really good business. Fair enough. Peace. Then he asks the Swiss guy, yo, dude, why do you want to become a cave diver? And the Swiss guy says, well, you know, there's no caves where I live, but I really, you know, from what I know, the whole technique of like being flat and reverse frog kick and helicopter turn, all of that sounds really good to me. I really want to, you know, have those, practice that stuff. And then he asked me, and I'm just looking at the other two, like, what are you guys talking about? I want to be an explorer. Like, why would anybody learn how to cave dive? I want to explore, bro. And I remember Matt looking at me, just laughing. And he says, yeah, yeah, whatever. Who is laughing now, Matt? I hope you hear this. Nah, I'm just joking. Me and Matt, we're still in a lot of contact. And he's super stoked about everything that I do. But yeah, this was my thought. I mean, to tell you the God honest truth, when we were in Ponderosa and we were about to do our first cave dive, and they go like, well, you know, we're going to do the S drill, and then we're going to do a valve drill, and then we're going to do primary and secondary tie-off, and then we're going to connect to the line that's already installed in the cave. I was like, hang on a second. What do you mean there's already a line in the cave? I'm telling you, I did not know. And he was like, well, there's permanent guidelines inside the cave. I'm like, what? What are we bringing all this fucking reason for? And he goes like, well, he goes, we have to connect the open water to the main line. And then if we want to divert from the main line to offshoot passages, we have to connect those two. That's what the schools are for. I was devastated. I was like, that's so boring. I want to explore. I want to lay the line all the time, dude. So yeah, that's the truth. That is the truth, man. That was my first experience in cave diving. So then I was there for 2 months, and then I went back to Egypt. I had started rebreather diving on a buddy inspiration at that time. And then Matt obviously was a really huge guy on rebreathers. He had a certificate from INTD that said INTD CCR cave god Andreas Vimates, because at the time he had certified more rebreather cave divers than anybody else put together. And so he convinced me to buy a Megalodon rebreather, which I did. And so I came back in 2006 for another 2 months, doing the crossover to that rebreather and then putting the hours on it and then doing a CCR cave crossover. And yeah, and at that time, I made the decision to leave recreational diving and move away from Egypt. My time in Egypt was just done. You know, everything that I could have gotten out of this place, I had gotten out of it. And for me, it was really starting to be really quite intense to, you know, do 120, 400 foot dives and do like helping local researchers with like black coral research. And then suddenly on a Monday, standing in a pool, watching a new instructor performing DSDs. I was just like, this is not fulfilling for me anymore. So I had to move. Also, my parents' patience were running quite thin because now we're like a couple of years in and they're like, hey, at some point you have to go to university, huh, Patrick? So I'm like, yay! let me just do one more thing. I want to become a cave instructor. So the plan was I wanted to move to Sardinia, right? An island off the coast of Italy that has caves also. It's part of the European Union and is seasonal. So the idea was, first of all, I'm back in the European Union, which means, you know, healthcare, pension plan, the whole nine yards. Second, it's seasonal. So in the off season, I would be at home spending time with my family, right? Which my family at that time, remember, I left when I was like 18, 19. For my family, it's really hard, specifically for my mom. You know, at that time, there was no WhatsApp yet. There was barely Skype. Not the first 2 years. The first 2 years, my mom had to call me in the hotel in Egypt, which the price was ridiculous. I only remember in shilling, the currency we had before the euro, but it was like 120 shillings per minute. Like, for, it was a fortune. I mean, imagine considering to what my mom earns as a school principal, it was like $200 the hour. It's something outrageous. Not the hour, sorry, the minutes. The minutes. Something outrageous. Something complete. Like my mom would be able to call me for like 5 minutes a week. Like that was it. And it was devastating for her financially. So, and you know, by the time she called me, first the reception, then they had to put me to the room. It was terrible. Right. And then my mom would come in the summer to visit me and in the winter to visit me in her vacation. And every single time she left, she was just crying for 2 days nonstop. It was gut wrenching. So I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to be in Sardinia and then I'm going to be closer to my mom. So I started to study Italian with a CD at that time. And then I went to Sardinia, you know, I had the job interview with the people there because there was a franchise of Protec in Sardinia. I mean, it's still there. It's just not a franchise no more, called Protec Sardinia. And it had two owners, Patrick from Switzerland and Toddy from Germany. So I got to meet them, looked for an apartment, blah, 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 blah. Everything good. And the idea was that Matt from Protec Mexico would come once a year to Sardinia, you know, train Patrick and Toddy in deep diving and rebreather diving, instructor levels and so forth and so forth. And would each year do one of the levels of cave diving with me, Kevin the first year, Intro the second, Full Cave the third. And I was a bit skeptical because, again, they kind of like hired me to be a dive master, right? But I was like a drumming instructor and a paddy master instructor. And I was not really into guiding people in the Mediterranean. But I also thought, well, that's what I have to do to become a cave instructor. That's what I have to do, right? So plus the dive shop had like scooters. So like, cool, on my time off, I can like take scooters and go cave diving. So yeah, that was all sorted. Then I went to Mexico for my Megalodon training. And at some point, Matt invites me to the office and he goes like, so how do you feel about moving to Sardinia and everything? And I'm like, that's super, super awesome, dude. I'm looking forward to it. Cave diving, like more technical diving. And, you know, they have scooters. But, you know, to another point, it's a bit strange, you know, that my bosses in rebreather diving and in technical diving are actually have less experience than me, are lower certified than I am. So that's going to be a bit weird, you know, but I'm not there for mostly focused on rebreather diving and technical diving. I'm focused on cave diving, and both of them and cave diving are very, very experienced, specifically Toddy. So I'm looking forward to that. Good. A week later, I receive an email from Patrick at the time, not Swiss Patrick, the owner of one of the owners of Protec Sardinia. And he goes, we discussed the whole situation again, and we realized you're overqualified for the position that we have to offer. And we have to, unfortunately, you know, retract the job offer we had for you.
Oh.
So I'm sitting in the reception of mom's hotel in Mexico. And I'm just like, I can't even describe the emotion I had. I was like, wow, bro, I have suddenly no more future because I moved all my shit out of Egypt already. I didn't burn the bridges, but I definitely didn't want to go back there. And now I have nothing, right? And I'm not in my early 20s no more, right? I'm in my mid 20s. So it's not like, I don't know. I mean, looking back now, I'm still crazy young. But at that moment, I didn't feel that young anymore. I'm like, holy shit, like, you want me to go to university now? So I'm going to be like 26 and I'm going to hang out with guys that are 18. Like after all the life experiences that I made, like, wow, man, that's going to be hard. So I'm just like, I'm in shock. And Matt comes in and he looks at me and goes like, wow, what happened to you? Because I must have been rather pale. And I'm like, I just got fired. I haven't even started yet. And I just got fired. And he goes like, awesome. You're going to come and work for me then? Which was the opposite of what I wanted to do. I wanted to move closer home, not across the Atlantic. 7-hour time difference, 10,000 kilometers in that direction. But, you know, dude, it was like not really optional at that moment. Like, what else am I going to do? Like, go to university? You know, depend on my parents' money? You crazy. So, yeah, then in March 2007, I moved to Mexico. And, you know, if you want to know it, I flew with an airline at the time called Martin Air. It doesn't exist anymore. It was Dutch. So I flew through Amsterdam. And I'm standing on Amsterdam airport. And I cried full on. I'm at the gate. And I'm crying. I'm with a really, really close friend of mine on the phone, a girl from France, from Aix-en-Provence, who I used to work together with in Egypt. And I'm crying. I'm uncontrollably crying because I'm so terrified of moving to Mexico. Terrified, dude. I'm going to be 10,000 kilometers. I can't speak the language. I'm by myself. I don't have friends there. I don't have family. I know nobody there. I have to buy a car. I have no money. I just took the 3,700 euros from my disability insurance. I'm terrified. When I said goodbye to my mom, I tried that she doesn't realize, but I'm on the airport. I'm with my friend on the phone and just, I let it rip, dude. People around the gate look at me. At some point, one of them is like, are you okay? She would fly. I'm like, I'm really, really terrified. So this was my start into this whole thing. Dude, fast forward 2014 or whatever. So 7 years later, we have the Christmas party of ProTech up on the roof. And I'm sitting next to Matt, and Matt goes a bit on the piss, so he's a bit drunk. And we talk about, you know, building ProTech Tulum and how everything is going so good. And he goes like, dude, aren't you happy that I got you fired back then and that you did go to Sardinia but moved here? I'm like, what do you mean you got me fired? And he's like, well, remember when you said like you found it a bit weird that you're like higher certified than technical diving and rebuild diving than the guys there? And well, I just told them. I mean, dude, honestly, I just wanted you to work for me. So I just, you know, told them that you would not be happy there and it would be bad for their business. So they fired you and then I could hire you. No, obviously now it was too late to be angry, specifically considering how everything worked out.
It was almost like it was meant to happen though, right? Because like you going to Mexico and, you know, just accomplishing the things that you accomplished, that's pretty fucking awesome, man.
I mean, Nick, I can tell you straight up, there is several times during a year when I literally sit down and I'm like, I'm from a 700 people village in the middle of nowhere. Like, dude, there's one road. So I grew up in the last village before the tallest mountain in Austria, right? The Großglockner. And there is an Alpine road, which is super famous. Like each year you have like the meetings of Mercedes and Porsche and old timers and vintage cars. And right, because it's one of the tallest high altitude Alpine roads in Europe. And in the winter, it's closed. So in the winter, there's only one road that goes into my village and out of my village. That's it. It's just houses with a river and mountains on each side. Actually, the term Fusch, which is the name of the village, comes from the Latin word fusca, which means dark brown, the dark, right? Because we have so little sunlight in the winter because of the tall mountains. And now I'm like, now I'm suddenly in Madagascar exploring caves. Like, dude, it is literally completely and utterly. Dude, sometimes I have to sit down and I'm like, I can't even believe. Maybe I died at some point. And all of this is just in my imagination. Dude, I don't know. I might be in coma somewhere. Because it seems so outrageously ridiculous that these things keep happening to me. That it is ridiculous. I'll give you a quick example. So remember, I opened this book and I saw the whole climbing and diving, but I honestly never ended up in this type of cave exploration, like multi-sump and caving, right? Because I went straight into diving. And then every time I looked at the caving thing, it looked like, well, all the shit parts of cave without the fun part. Really murky water, super exhausting, walking somewhere really far with the backpack sounds horrible. Then we did a project in Brazil. And for the first time, I walked through a dry cave and I thought, holy smokes, this is awesome. Right, it was so beautiful. And through 15 other, I end up doing a rigging class. So how to install ropes to descend and ascend in vertical shafts. I do this in France with a friend, blah, blah, blah. And during this class, I get completely hooked and mind blown by the rigging activity. But how do you go down this really terrifying fucking hole in the floor using as little equipment as possible? The rope can never touch the rock. Make sure that you don't drill into something that's going to crush down on you. It's terrifying. It's three-dimensional chess. And it's just mind-blowing, right? This mix of like fear, physical exertion. I don't know. I love it. I love it. I love it. So when he puts the equipment together, when he washes the equipment, I ask him, yo, mate, because I realize if I don't own this equipment, I will never keep on practicing. And all what I just did was for nothing. So I'm like, yo, dude, how much is all the equipment? And he goes like, for you, 1,200. And I'm like, oh, fuck it. I buy it. Okay. I grab everything. So now I'm back in Austria. And all I'm thinking is, okay, now I have all the equipment. Where can I practice? And I'm like, dude, I live in the Yucatan. Dude, the highest elevation of the Yucatan is like 50 feet. I'm like, meh. So now I'm like contacting everybody that I know that has anything to do with dry caving. And everybody's like, well, in Veracruz. And that's like, you know, 2 days by car. Or, you know, come to Oaxaca. Well, that's 2 days. It just seems like with my current schedule, when I'm going to have the time to actually do this. And there was this neighboring state, though, from where I live called Chiapas. But Chiapas, you know, there's the Zapatistas there. It might be a bit sketchy place. But through other people that I know, I come to somebody that I know that lives there on the side of the mountain in a village. And I contact him like, hey, you guys have caves there? And then there's the potential maybe they have. So I'm about to move back to travel back to Mexico. I'm in my mom's apartment and I've like, dude, I'm packing my bags and the diving equipment, the climbing. I'm just thinking like, how in the world I'm going to put all of this in suitcases and how I'm going to explain customs in Mexico why I rock up with like 150 meters of rope, 20, I don't know, 50 carabiners, 20, a drill, 2 dry suits, 8 regulators. I was just like, I have like no idea what to say. I'm trying to open a diving and climbing shop. So I'm standing there, and in the same time, in my diving, my work team Protec, we have a WhatsApp group, right? And I'm going on the WhatsApp group, and I'm like, hey guys, I know that all of you are quite upset with me because I'm never home, right? Because I'm the training director, and they can just advance their career if I'm there. At least at this point now, with another instructor trainer. But I'm like, I know you're really upset at me, but I still have to share something with you. I'm mind blown by vertical caving. It might be maybe the third thing in my life besides cave diving and surfing that really captured my soul. And I honestly, right now, I have like this really bizarre fantasy of me driving up a mountain in a 4x4 truck with my dog. And I'm going to camp on the mountain, and I'm going to explore as a first human in this area, vertical caves. In the same time, I understand how ridiculous that sounds, living in Playa del Carmen. 11 months later, I'm driving up the mountain in Chiapas with my brand new 4x4 truck, my dog, and my tent that I just bought online, which I have no idea about camping whatsoever. But I just talk to people and I have like this shout. I just bought shit on Amazon, bro. And here we are. And I find like several caves, 2 of them, which are currently deeper than 300 meters, 1,000 feet.
And, oh, shit.
Bro, that's what I'm telling you. Sometimes I'm like, I think I'm dead or I'm in a coma. Because there's no way that all this shit just keeps happening to me.
Dude. Oh, man, that's fucking awesome, dude.
Having said that, because, you know, all of this sounds like, wow, I'm like living the dream, right? And everything's awesome. I really, really have to say something really, really clearly here. There was insane amounts of difficult parts of my life and insane amounts of suffering. When I started with Protec, obviously I had no money. I had to take a bank credit, which I couldn't, right? Because I never worked in Austria. I had zero work history. So in order to take the credit from the bank, my mom, crazy as she is, had to put her house as a collateral for the credits. So I could take the credit to become... I don't want to get into too much detail, but the amount of stress, I suffered from insomnia. I had to go to treatment, because obviously also the relationship with my business partner at the time, Matt, you know, he was like my mentor in cave diving, 15 years older than me, massive German guy, like you know, just this huge, and he was intimidating like a mother. And I'm like this non-confrontational don't want to argue. Tiny. Hans, my friend from Jersey, calls me a girl-sized man friend. I'm like this. I can just tell you, there was a lot of really, really intense times in my life where, man, like, you know, people complain about grinding their teeth at night, dude. If I would have had metal in between, I would have grinded. So, you know, nothing in life, what I'm trying to say is nothing in life is easy. And doing all the things that I do, there's a lot of suffering involved, or like a lot of like really intense, difficult decisions, really long days, exertion. That is why for me, like the whole caving and exploration part is almost like relaxing. You're waking up super early and just carrying your equipment and going diving and doing a couple of hours. That's like relaxing to me compared to my day by day. So it's really important. And specifically because of the days of social media, everybody just looks at social media and it's like, oh, wow, what a fucking amazing life. And I'm like, I would honestly tell you, I would say for 99% of people, if I give them my life for like 2 or 3 weeks or a month, most people would be like, yeah, no, thank you. Like, and I just want to make this clear. It looks really amazing from the outside. I know that because people keep on telling me that. But I really don't think it's for everybody. Because it's certainly a lot of times in my life, I'm just, you know, it's really pretty intense. That's all I want to say. I don't want that people walk away with this illusion of like, oh, wow. I think most, and also I'm hanging out with very successful people from different branches of life. And like my friend Hans, like Piotr, the owner of XDeepin, I think very few people understand how really, really unbelievable, difficult and intense lives like these are sometimes.
Oh yeah, it's like that. That it reminds me of the there's like that picture that you'll see where it's like the iceberg, like what most people see, yeah, the tip of the iceberg, but they don't see all the shit underneath that was created for that one little picture. You've accomplished a lot, and that there's definitely, I'm sure, been very tough moments. I mean, shit, you've explained quite a few of them on here. So on the exploration side, so once you completed cave training and, you know, you were bummed out, like, what, there's permanent line in the cave, do you remember the first time you went, like your first exploration, or the first time like after the training?
Of course. how would you forget that?
Well, yeah, I mean, because tell me about it. Like, what were there, were you nervous, like, just kind of, because
of course it's terrifying.
Did you have like a team? Were you by yourself? I mean, it's different for everybody. That's why I always ask.
Yes. But the first time you boldly go where no man has gone before, yeah, it's terrifying, of course. It's still terrifying. It's another thing that I need to clarify very, very, very strongly. I'm not brave. Not at all. I'm terrified. Vast amounts of time during exploration, both in dry caving, maybe all the time. Dude, I already fell and broke my back. So hanging from ropes on really, specifically the ones that I installed, dude, there's nobody else to blame. I'm terrified, bro. Absolutely terrified. Right now, because I haven't done it in some time, if I just think about it, dude, I'm terrified. I'm like, do I still remember how to make those knots? So, thanks God there's a saying, if you don't know knots, tie lots. So I can do at least many of them. Yes, I remember perfectly. It was a cave behind a strip club in Mexico called Chili Willy's. And I was exploring there with a guy named Nando, which was a coworker of mine in Protec. So no, I remember this perfectly. And an interesting one I want to point out is, at some point I'm sitting in Protec Playa, and there's this new guy coming in from Tulum that lives in Tulum since some time. And he wants to become a cave instructor. So he wanted to start his training with my former business partner, Matt, right? Which was an instructor trainer from INTD and the license holder of INTD Mexico. And he just walks in and is this tall, blue eyed Viking from Sweden. And his name is Kim. And he looks at me, I don't know. You know, there's certain people you meet in life where if I would believe in it, which I don't, you'd be like, we met in a life, in a previous life. Somehow he's the two. I don't know, dude. I'm like, you're my type of you're my type of dude. I want to hang out with you. So I'm like, yo. And at the time, you know, there was no highway yet down, or like the dual lane highway to Tulum. So like traveling to Tulum at that time was like an hour. Then for some time it was 30 minutes. Now it's an hour again. So I'm like, hey, I don't really know very well the caves down there, which sounds so ridiculous when I say this now. But anyways, would you mind to like guide me? And he goes like, yeah, of course. Just come down. But he goes like, but if you come down, we're not going to dive normal caves, right? We're going to go exploring. I'm like, whoa, 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 bro. So anyways, I came the first time to Tulum and we dove in a place called Babtsots, which is like the swimming, it's in Mayan and it means like the swimming bat, if I remember correctly. And we're like looking for leads and dive a little bit and don't really find much. We go back to his house and Kim drinks about 25 liters of coffee per day. So he's a pretty excited human being. He's like, so bro, okay, this is totally secret. You cannot tell anybody. I tried to connect Sakaktun with Oshbelha, right? The two longest caves in the world. And I have, this is my plan. Okay, so listen, and he set me down. He's like this fucking excited person who moves his hands a lot. And he had an excellent plan, right? And it involved a cave system in between the two called Lucka, which is Swedish for luck. If I fuck this up, sorry, Swedish people. But this is how I remember it, at least. And we start exploring. And we become really good friends. And we explore caves together. And we found then another world called Sandcrack. Well, actually, truth be told, how did they find Sandcrack? Which then turned out to be one of the biggest projects we did as a team. Was Matt at that time, and huge kudos to him. At way back then, he understood, I think Tulum is going to be the future. There's way more caves down there in close proximity. And even though Playa is a city and Tulum is a village, I think the future of cave diving might be more in Tulum. I think we should look into opening a facility in Tulum, specifically because now it seems like there's going to be more popping up. And I told him, okay, do you want to move to Tulum? No. Patrick, I want to move to Tulum for sure not. In the same time, I'm from a small fucking village. I don't need to move back to a small village. I'm okay with the town. But in the same time, we also knew that Tulum was very clicky. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Man, it would be nice to have a dude from there. First of all, a guy that lives there. Second, that knows the clickies, the clicks. And third, ideally somebody that is really liked by the community there. And I'm like, I have the perfect person. However, during his instructor training with Matt, Kim and Matt, so Matt, really huge, intense German guy, Kim, intense Swedish guy. So intense and intense usually don't work very good together. So in the first level, which was the advanced nitrox, they did a dive in Angelita, and then Matt failed him because Kim didn't check his pressure gauge for like half an hour or something like that. And Kim just basically told him to get lost in not so nice English. So now I'm like, okay, so I have this really perfect guy, but the two of you are not like on the best possible terms at this point in time. So anyways, and Matt was like, I don't care. I can make peace. You know, really, what you tell me about him? Because Kim has crazy OCD also. So he's ex-Swedish military. But the best thing that I can explain you about Kim is like, he used to have a shed for diving equipment attached to his house. And the first time I walked into the shed, every tool, every regulator, every piece of equipment had its own designated specific place. And I walked in and I'm like, holy smokes. You need therapy. But it seems like you're the type of guy I want to go in business with. But anyways. I didn't tell him that. So fast forward again. So we are hiking through the jungle on the way to Lucca. And Kim is like on a rant. And he was like, ah, dude, you know, man, again, I took the tanks from the fill station and they were not full. And man, this is so devastating. There's like nobody in Tulum that does a really, really proper job. And, you know, everybody is like kind of like lazy and then they don't fill tanks. And then it's just like nonsense. Like, you know, Tulum, considering it's like the capital of caves in the world, really would deserve, you know, a triple A proper facility that really, really, really does a professional job. And then he turns around and looks at me. He's like, you guys, man, you should do like a protect here in Tulum. And I'm like, funny that you would mention that. Matt and I already have come down here and looked at real estate and like different locations to put a shop since like the past 3 months. And he's just like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I haven't told you, but we already scouted locations and we're pretty sure we found one and we want to open Protect Tulum there. Oh, yeah. And by the way, we also think about making you a business partner in that business if you want. And he was like, you can't do this to me. You can't fuck with my mind before an expiration. I'm calling it that. And I'm like, oh, come on, dude. Don't be that guy. Nick's like, no, dude, I can't dive right now. You go dive. I put you in the water. I help you with the tanks and everything. You go explore. But dude, I can't. Now my mind is like all screwed up. I can't do this. Right? He just became the second time father at that time. So for him, it was a big decision also, right? Like,
yeah,
married, kids, how much time? And truth be told, what an intense decision. What a difficult decision. And sometimes I'm not sure it was the correct one because he did lose quite a lot of time with his family because of the intense amount of work we did the past 10 years. In the same time, of course, you know, financially and career-wise, his life turned out really good.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Anyways, so that day, he puts me in the water and he goes jungle walking, right? There is like this huge fracture, a fault line in the jungle that you can actually quite easily follow. And that day he found sand cracking. Yeah. Like he found that entrance to like, and then later we explored it. I don't remember how much kilometers of line there is, but a lot. Yeah. So this was like the second really big project of a group of friends we had at that time to explore together. And he has been my business partner ever since. That was since 2011. And yeah, at some point, Matt wanted to leave Protect because at the time we were two partners in Protect Playa, Matt and I, three partners in Tulum with Kim. And then when Matt went out, we adopted as a business partner also Rusalba, which used to be the secretary, so to speak, of Protect. So when we restructured the company, we thought, dude, she has been in Protect since 2001. She's like the big sister of everybody. She deserves to have a part of this, right? So we gave her a percentage of Protect and to make her business partner also, you know, give her the status that she deserves flat out.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kim became a partner also, or like became an owner of the whole thing. And that is that. And this is how that then evolved. And very recently, in fact, since January, we have, besides Hans, my best friend, which is always a partner also, which, you know, I knew, remember, I went to a normal school. I had like no idea about business, accounting, none of this, dude. I didn't even know, you know, what is compounding interest? I knew none of these things, dude. So everything and anything I know about business, I know from Hans. And he's like my number one person to consult when I'm like stuck with something. So he got a percentage of Protect also. And this year in January, we sold a piece of the company to one of our youngest, or is he the youngest of our instructors, Jake Bullman.
Oh,
which
cool.
it wasn't a thing about money, but he has just an insane amount, like the same drive that Kim has and that I have, he has. Right? Because go and teach diving all day is very exhausting, right? And a bunch of my staff, when it's like back to back for like whatever, 2 weeks, they complain about it, right? Because the days are really long. Specifically, if you want to do some sort of like physical activity, like stretching or yoga or gym the same day, then it's like, you know, whatever. The class starts at 8:30 and it's done by 7. So that's already like almost 12-hour day. Plus then you add stuff that you want to do for yourself. It's very, very long days and consecutive. Yeah. So to find somebody that besides that, then is also going to invest like 2 or 3 hours sitting on a computer doing something that doesn't have immediate return on investment, it takes a special type of mental sickness. And when you find a person like that, then you go like, you know.
No, for sure. That's awesome, man. I'm actually really excited, and I've reached out to, well, obviously you, and then just kind of put the word out because I'd like to interview some people from ProTech. You obviously have like a pretty all-star team.
Lately, it has been really amazing, and I'm super ultra stoked and proud about the team that we have. simply because they're so unbelievable dedicated people. And not only dedicated, it's easy to be dedicated just to diving, right? But to be really dedicated to become a really good educator, right? To learn how to teach, right? To learn how to do a good theory presentation, to stay within the time, which I'm terrible in, by the way, but to stay within the time constraints. I'm terrible in the time constraints, as you can already tell. To really, really practice their skill as an educator, as a teacher, and then to become a really good diver also, right? To become motionless, to become very aware about everything that happens around you, to be able to do a really good debriefing. Like all of these are very, very difficult skills to master, and they spend a lot of time practicing that. And then in their spare time, they still go diving. And they all, the money that they make, they invest in travel to go to other places to dive there to gain more experience. So to find, and now our team is quite huge, to be honest, quite big, to find so many people that are so dedicated to their craft is, and to build this team is maybe amongst the biggest challenges, yet the most rewarding ones in my life.
Wow, that's awesome, man.
To train people like the guys that work for us, and then to see them become really good instructors and really good, having their own careers and becoming, you know, known for their teaching and diving capabilities and abilities makes me really proud. But then also to believe that I help to create a new generation of instructors and divers that are gonna become better than I am, no more, you know, whatever. All the mistakes that I do, I can show them, don't do that. Right, this is what limits me. Use what I know as a foundation. Like, don't. I always tell them at the very beginning of the training, I was like, don't try to become a second Patrick. Patrick should be like your foundation, and then you go above and beyond. Right, if you only want to become as good as your mentor, then it's, there's no evolution happening. Right, your mentor should be like your foundation, your base, and then you go further than that.
No, so, that's awesome, man.
And to see them, you know, achieve those things and helping them to achieve those things is really cool.
Cool. Well, my last question for you before I let you go is, and this is, I guess, kind of a personal for me because I'm about to venture more into the overhead. Out of the, you know, the track record that you have, what advice could you give to somebody that is about to start their overhead journey? What is the best piece of advice that you could give to that person?
No shortcuts. And I know if, and I'm sure nobody, but if part of my team would listen to this, they would all laugh because I tell them like 50,000 times per week. No shortcuts. Handpick your instructor, meaning research what they do. Don't look for somebody that has a fancy webpage, a fancy Instagram account, or is cheap. Look for a person that does the type of diving that you want to do, right? And that does it a lot and intensively. If your cave diving will maybe have you travel, then make sure that, you know, this cave instructor not only knows about cave diving in Mexico or in Florida or in France, but have already traveled. So they can tell you, well, in France it's like this, in Sardinia it's like this, in Bahamas it's like this, and whatever, right? So get somebody that does a lot of diving outside. You will not, so listen, this is really, really an important piece. To become really good in this, you need to have both. You need to teach a lot, right? Because teaching is a skill. So if you don't teach a lot, you're not going to be a good teacher. End of story. If you just teach, what real life experience you have to share, right? Sometimes when I'm in the parking lot and I listen to people talking about serious ability, I'm like, everything that you say is because you don't really know. But all of this is like stuff that you read in books. But honestly, there's also like some people invent like contraptions about how to cut line, which is like an arrow and another arrow and a bungee. And it's like, yeah. You guys have no real experience. Because in real life, it's not like that at all, right? So line doesn't wrap itself around you when there's tension on it. So you know what I mean? So you can see that many people spend a lot of time to think about different scenarios, but they're just not plausible. And the reason why they don't know that they're not plausible is because they haven't experienced it. Right? And teaching is sharing experience. Just imagine, before there was teachers and instructors, how was information relayed from one generation to the next? The old dude explained it to the young dude. Right? The old woman explained it to the young woman. That's how it went. Right? It's sharing experience. right? In Austria, we have what is called farmer's wisdom. And it's usually in a rhyme scheme even, where like the farmer told you if there is, the moon is high, then the rain is, whatever, you know? So it's sharing experience. So if you don't have experience, what are you sharing? Right. And I realize this quite often also when I look like through standards or I read books or we have like these meetings of like the board of directors of training agencies. And you talk to some of the older guys there also about like, what should we do standard wise? And many times when I listen to them, it's like, man, you don't have real life experience in this too, because it's just not like that at all. Right. So there's a lot of like, you know, when people just do normal diving, and I'm not disrespecting this, but when, you know, they go cave diving just to follow a line and come back out, but they haven't laid the line, right? They haven't experienced serious ability for prolonged periods of time. They haven't been in a place where you had to dive with equipment that wasn't 100% because you're at the end of the world. And it's like, you either dive with not perfect equipment or you're not diving. There's certain experiences that you can only make in this type of environment. And then the teaching, of course, right? Because now there's also this other misconception. Are you going to go to one of these really big explorers or world record holders in deep diving and he's going to teach you how to deep dive? No, you don't know how to teach. And second, you shouldn't dive like him because he's the world record holder, right? His lessons are not your lessons. His way of doing it is not your way of doing it. Take tennis, for example. First thing you learn in tennis is you always have your leading foot in the direction the ball is supposed to go. But, and then you watch, well, maybe people don't watch Sampras anymore, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal. Right? And you see their legs are parallel to each other because they're professional. Like, don't play like a professional. Play like the level that you're in. Right? And this is another thing that people just completely get mixed up. When people are very passionate hobby divers and they dive every weekend, and then also because maybe some professionals are not that professional, but then at some point they go like, well, I'm as good as a professional. No, you're not. Right? You cannot do it. If you do 50 or 100 hours a year, you cannot dive or do things than somebody that does 300 or 400 hours a year. Specifically, if they do 300 or 400, if 20% of those hours are in really difficult environments. So you need somebody that teaches a lot. Also because if you just dive for yourself, right, you're an explorer or whatever, the only mistakes that you learn from are the ones you did yourself. Right? Or the ones that maybe your team partnered it. Now, when you are teaching and you constantly create scenarios, you will learn so much. But first of all, you create the scenarios that are not very likely to happen in real life or not a lot. And then you see how people reacted to it and what mistakes they made. And you learn from their mistakes. So if you really, 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 really want to become insanely good, you have to do both. You have to do some sort of like a bit on the edge diving, like some really pretty advanced diving to get real life experience. And you have to teach a lot to learn how to teach and to get, I have all of the different ways of how shit can go wrong. So this is the person that I would look for. And then I would practice a lot. And then I would understand these are perishable skills. Man, when people tell me, oh, yeah, I want to cross over to the side one. How many days is it? I'm like 5 days because we also do like a review. I don't need the review, dude. I'm certified on two reviews. And you go like, can you imagine Michael Jordan saying, I don't need to practice my jump shot, bro. Like I know how to jump shot since high school. It's just ridiculous. It's a sport. Of course you have to practice. You know, and I'm not even only talking about the physical thing. There's also the theoretical thing. How much time do you spend on your day-to-day life thinking about hypoxia and studying it? You know, and guess what? If you did your course 4 years ago, our understanding of hypercapnia has changed since then, right? So your information might not be up to date, bro. So
yeah.
So this is the thing about people and the certification cards. And I would always suggest to people, you know, maybe not only doing a course, like maybe you go now to Mexico and you do your cave class, right? Maybe a year from now, not pursuing necessarily a higher level of training, like staging or, but you could be like, hey, whoever instructor X, I'm coming back to Mexico. Could I hire you for 2 or 3 days? I pay you a per day rate. And then I would like to work on my line laying. Hey, I would like to spend 1 day of reviewing and practicing against serious ability drills on land in confined water and then in the cave. Hey, I would really like to practice navigation, right? So I think that people should break away a little bit from that whole certification approach, pyramid approach, because this is anyway a thing. I can guarantee you people that rush through this pyramid, which is possible because, you know, at the end of the day, everybody tries to make money and a lot of instructors just sell, which is no disrespect, but they're, you know, trying to get people to commit to a lot of courses, which is good anyways, right? Because then the student, there's a lot of training also and there's money in the diving industry and whatnot. But at the same time, I guarantee you, if you rush through your education, if you rush through your training, you will be whatever, TriMix, DPV, CCR, CAVE, you name it, in 2 years. If you have the money and time, piece of cake, and you will stop diving because you will perceive there's no more challenge. I guarantee you, I've seen it more times than I can remember. People that take their time with their training, and I know patience in the days of social media is basically non-existing anymore. But if you take this serious and you really try to master each level before you move on, it will be a passion that you will be capable to expand over a longer period of time. I would also say if you have a regular job and you do diving on the side, if you jump in the water and you don't think, or you look at your instructor and you don't think, wow, this guy dives good, you maybe should choose a different instructor. If you believe that you dive as good or similar good as the person that teaches you, or you know more, whatever, then maybe you should look for somebody else. And I guess that's all the advice I have.
Absolutely amazing advice. I was just listening to that. I'm like, man, you should be a motivational speaker, man. You're getting me motivated over here, man. No, that's absolutely great advice, man. And no, that was highly motivating, dude. Thank you.
Because honestly, this is also what I did in my career since the early beginning. I told you I like trained with Lee Cunningham at the time because he was the world record holder. Of course, I did not know all of that. He was also teaching a lot, but of course, I did not know what I know now. But I chose always my instructors very, very carefully. I never cared about the training agency. I never cared about the level specific. I just wanted to be with specific people. You had Jared Szablonski on your podcast?
Yes.
Yeah, I trained with Jared Szablonski.
Oh, no shit.
In 2014, I believe. Yeah, something like that. Wow, 10 years ago. Crazy. I always chose people very, very specifically. And it was mostly, honestly, quite expensive and quite difficult to do. When I trained with Lee Cunningham, my mom arrived in Egypt to visit me. And the next day I left to Sharm el Sheikh for a week. My mom was there for 2 weeks. So she spent the first week completely by herself in a hotel. And then I came back from Sharm el Sheikh. She was not impressed. And I also didn't tell her. Like, she arrived and I'm like, hey, mom, tomorrow I'm leaving to Sharm. Sorry. It was the only time the guy had available. The same was really for, you know, to do training with Jared. I came to Florida. Then I trained with Ed Sorensen, went to Florida again and hung out there for like a month or more, like 3 weeks. So I really choose the people very carefully that I want to train with. And I would just recommend that to people. And even if it's not like, for example, and Ed, if you hear this, I'm sorry, but before I went to Ed, people around us created some sort of a conflict between him and me because we have very different styles of side mounting, right? And very different styles of cave diving in general, a different environment, different experience. So there was like, and we had a lot of students in common. And then there was always the he said, she said thing, like, oh, but Ed says this, oh, but Patrick says this. So they created almost like this confrontation. But when I went for Sidewinder, I knew there's only one guy in the world that I want to do this with, and it's him. So I knew it's going to be maybe a bit sketchy because it seems like he really don't like me. There's going to be maybe like pretty intense to train with somebody that's like a fucking animal of a person. He's massive, bro. He is intimidating, similar intimidating than Matt. And again, he is like really intense and I'm really anti-confrontational. So most of the time I'm just scared being around him, to be honest. But in the same time, dude, I just knew there's nobody in the world that will be able to teach me more and better on this thing in this moment than he is. And that's what has to be done. It has to be done. And then, you know, like I said, no shortcuts. Like, could I have taken a shortcut? Man, plenty. It would have cost me less time, less money. And money and time is not even the big thing. Overcoming my fear of having to deal with a person like him. like knowing that it might be like this, right? But just take no shortcuts. Because at the end of the day, and this is something so weird, if you take the easy way, which your brain will try to convince you to take the easy way, and there's going to be plenty of argumentation, less money, less time, easy to do, less headache, you know, it might be the better. Because at the end of the day, we have to understand one thing. Our brain always tries to conserve energy, because energy means we have to look for food to create. Now I'm getting like maybe two. But you have to understand, the voice in your head that tells you to take a shortcut is not your friend. We have to understand the voice in our head that tells us to it's from evolution. It just tries to conserve energy because it still thinks that food is scarce. Okay, just bear with me here. So when you understand that this voice is not your friend, because what's going to happen is you're going to take a shortcut. You will feel very little to no achievement from having reached that goal. Ultimately, it will not have no value for you because it came at zero expense. Maybe for some time you wave it around. Oh, I'm a cave instructor now. But deep down in yourself, you know it means nothing because you got it without breaking a sweat. There's no accomplishment. You don't feel proud of having it. And ultimately, you will just stop to be interested in it. If reaching this goal came at financial time and any expense, you would feel like, you know, I earned this. This is mine. I got this. The majority of people would have not been able to do this. Now it's going to be valuable to you. And to let go of it is going to be harder. So that's going to keep it interesting for a longer period of time. This is my experience.
That's awesome. And I definitely like that, to choose your instructor wisely, because I feel like I obviously, you know, it took me some time to learn that, but like now whenever I'm looking towards classes, I'm always like pretty like, okay, let me do a lot of research. I don't want to say stalking, but like, you know, I'm like, okay, I need to find out a lot of information before. Cause I mean, you know, it's like you were saying, it is time, it is money. So, you know, you want to try to make that investment wisely, which it is an investment. So
it's crazy, dude. And this is what I'm telling to people about me also. Right, when I teach abroad, they have to pay my flight tickets, my hotel. It's crazy expensive. It's crazy expensive, dude. And to everybody out there, to do a course with me abroad is crazy expensive. So you got to make sure this is really worthwhile for you. But this is also why I force people to take a lot of notes. Because I'm like, guys, this is so expensive. Sit down and take notes. Right, because I'm going to say so many things and everything is going to sound really logic and awesome. And 3 months from now, you will remember 30% of it, unless you take notes. Because it's, dude, it's so much information. Just think, well, actually, truth be told, and no, I do not condone that. But when people assist me, they record me on a regular basis. So sometimes I have like 3 or 4 telephones on the first table while I'm teaching, and it's terrifying. I'm like, I hope I'm not going to get canceled 10 years from now. Oh, but Patrick, 10 years ago, you said that helium is less narcotic. And now we find out suddenly it isn't. No, something like that, you know.
Yeah.
But I would definitely say that it's quite a lot of money. So just make sure you have a return on investment. You know, make sure that you invest it wisely. Because if not, you know, small money spent on nothing is worse than big money spent on something. You know what I mean? It's a bigger waste of money to spend little and then get nothing for it.
Well, awesome, man. Well, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast today, man. This has been absolutely wonderful, dude. It's been great to hear about your journey, your experiences, and definitely leaving here motivated tonight. So I appreciate it, man.
And you know, this is what I do and I really enjoy it. I just told you about training my team, or like the guys that work in ProTech. A big part of that is the motivating part and, you know, sharing stuff. Because at the beginning, right, at the very beginning of this interview, you asked me, you know, what do you do to keep motivated? And, you know, in part, doing podcasts like this one, reminding myself of all of those things. But every time I'm motivating somebody else, I motivate myself with it too. And this is also why I find things like this really interesting. And just generally reflecting about life, where I'm coming from, where I'm going, what I'm doing. It's just, you know, that I think from anybody, the most value out of this 2-hour podcast, I get myself. So it's actually quite selfish. So now I'm totally stoked. Also, I'm gonna go and work out.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast.